Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Everyday Black History. Happy Wednesday to you all. Happy Hump Day. Hopefully, as I always say, hopefully your week is going well and hasn't been too crazy for you. Up in New York, the weather's been a little up and down. First, you know, we have this warm weather, and now the weather's going down, and cold and flu season is never a good thing with the up and down weather, but you know, we out here maintaining, you know what I'm saying? We just trying to get by day to day as we do all the time. But today, you know, on Everyday Black History, as we are still in the beginning of the month and we are covering Black History, we're going to be talking about two men today who are in the finance field. We're going to talk about one from the past and one in the present. And they are, you know, both men, you know, successful men in the finance field and investment field, started their own, you know, companies and amassed fortunes just by, you know, their work and being respected people in their field, in the finance field that they've chosen. The first man we were going to cover goes by the name of John Rogers Jr. And John Rogers is an investor, philanthropist, and he founded Ariel Capital Management, which is known as Ariel Investments now. And Ariel Investments is said to be the largest minority-owned investment firm, you know, ever. It was founded in 1983 by John Rogers, and as of now, he's the chairman and CEO of the company. And as of now, the president of the company is a woman by the name of Melody Hobson. And Melody Hobson, interestingly enough, is married to George Lucas. But she's been the president of the company since May of 2000. And the company, you know, as we'll talk a little further about it later on, it employs, you know, it employs about 88 people, but it's owned by 95%. Of the board, the employees and the board own 95% of the company. So most of the company's employees are minorities. So it's interesting that a company that manages over $10 billion in assets and mutual funds is owned by 95% of the employees and the board. But as mentioned, as we talked about, it was started by John Rogers. And John Rogers, you know, just a little bit of background information on him. He was born March 31st, 1958, and he was raised in the Hyde Park area of the Chicago South Side. He had graduated from the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools in 1976, and he even went on to Princeton University, where he uses free time to learn about, you know, investment and the markets, the stock markets and everything. He used his time while he was there to glean market information at his local stock brokerage. He always kind of had a knack for finance. When he was young, his father started giving him dividend paying stocks at the young age of 12. And his parents, his mom, Jewel LaFontaine. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. She was the first black woman to graduate from the University of Chicago Law School in 1946, and she was a prominent lawyer. She was even, Richard Nixon was even going to appoint her as a Supreme Court Justice when he became president in 1960. But she was a prominent and respected lawyer, his father was a Tuskegee Airman. And he flew over 100 combat missions during World War II. And he also was a Cook County judge for 20 years. And even though his parents divorced when he was young, you can see the influence that they had on him, you know, because he grew up to be a very successful man on his own, you know, starting his own company as well. But one of his great-grandfathers even, it runs in the family, because one of his great-grandfathers owned the Stratford Hotel in Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma, which was known back in the early 20th century as the Black Wall Street. Unfortunately, the hotel was destroyed and the Tulsa race riots of 1921. You know, that's gotten a lot more attention over the years, you know, because the Tulsa race riots were, you know, kind of, you know, not kind of, it was dismissed from history. So, you know, a lot of us know a lot more about what happened then and how well, you know, Black Americans were doing back then and with businesses and home ownership. And so his great grandfather owned a hotel, which was a popular hotel in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the time. And Rogers, John, you know, helped to finance a documentary, Before They Die, detailing survivors' accounts of those race riots that were a race through history. But he went to Princeton. You know, he even played on the Princeton's basketball team. While he was there, he studied economics in Princeton. He graduated in 1980. And right after he graduated, he worked for a company by the name of William Blair & Company in Chicago. And in 1983, with financial backing from some family and friends, he opened up his own firm. And his first account was the Municipal Employees Annuity and Benefit Fund of Chicago. That was his first account. But he opened up Ariel Capital Management, and he used what's called value investment strategy. Now, I don't know much about investing. I'm not a stock person or a finance person, but his strategies, he had his own method to his strategies. But his firm and the mutual funds that they manage have always been among the industry's performance leaders and have been, on average, outperformed the market. You know, he'll take on companies that has a track record more so than new companies. And he invests in companies in a different way. Like most management firms would invest in stocks of companies that were conducting research and development. Say, for example, the AIDS virus. AIDS first came around in the 80s, a lot of companies were investing in conducting research and development in the cure. But he instead would prefer to invest in hospitals that treat AIDS victims so that the money that he invests and that he put into these hospitals, they would be able to get more resources and tools that they need to treat AIDS victims. You know, during the 80s, the early 80s, when they didn't really know what the AIDS virus was or how to combat it, it would take years for these companies to actually be able to come up with an effective cure. Actually, it took, you know, many years for them to come up with an effective cure for the AIDS virus. But so he instead would invest in the hospitals so that those hospitals can get the resources that they need to at least keep people living, you know, and treat them when, you know, who was affected with this virus during those years. And his typical holding period for a particular company or mutual fund or stock is for 4 or 5 years rather than the 14-month period of an average mutual fund. You know, so he had his own way, or the company had their own way of how they would, you know, invest in the mutual fund market. But as mentioned, they always outperformed the market, and they always were among the performance leaders in the industry. So, you know, it worked for him. The company has grown steadily throughout the years. When he founded the firm in July 1983, he did it with $10,000, which he turned into $23,000 by the end of February 1984, which is only about 6 months after he started, and this is in 1980s money. He took the company public in November of 1986. And the company could just continue to grow throughout the late 80s and the 90s as well. By November 2000, he had 41 employees. By 2002, February, he had 51 employees and more than 120 institutional clients, some of which were United Airlines, Chevron Texaco, a gas company, and the California State Teachers Retirement System Fund. And that grew to include institutional clients such as Walmart and PepsiCo by April 2005. As of 2008, the company has over 100 employees. So you can see that steady growth in this company and how they got bigger and bigger clients, including, you know, blue chip companies like Walmart and PepsiCo, or even, you know, Chevron, Texaco. When you get one of those gas oil companies, you know, that's what you want if you're an investment management firm. They changed their name to Aerial Investments LLC in 2008. And he's also, John Rogers is also on the board of directors of several publicly traded companies, a lot of Chicago-based operations, including Exelon and Bally Total Fitness Corporation. And he's contributed to Forbes magazine for many, many years, giving financial tips and financial advice and even commentaries on different financial schemes. And he's also been awarded and honored a lot by the community, his community in Chicago, by the Black American community as well. He received the Woodrow Wilson Award from Princeton, which made him the first Black American to win that in 2008. And he also was co-chairman of Jesse Jackson's annual Wall Street Project Minority Conference, chairman of the Chicago Urban League, and he was a member of four corporate boards, three of which are Fortune 500 companies, Exelon Corporation, as we mentioned, McDonald's, and Ion Corporation. So, you know, he made a lot of, you know, friends in the finance and the corporate world. And because of that, he's able to sit on the board of a lot of these companies and, you know, help make decisions with a lot of these companies. He's a trustee of the University of Chicago. And Aerial Investments, because of he's actually was able to sponsor, you know, some schools in the Chicago school system. And they were part of a network of community partners that supported the Aerial, that supported the Chicago school system. And the Aerial Community Academy was born from, you know, the financial support that he gave and the sponsorship. Since he sponsored, you know, the Chicago school system, they were able to start his company, Aerial Investments, was able to start the Aerial Community Academy, which emphasizes financial literacy in its curriculum. And he donates time, he donates money, he even designed, you know, curriculum and brings some of the students to board meetings. So that no doubt is effective because they're able to see how these big businesses work at firsthand at a young age. As a result of his time and money investing that he invested in the Aerial Community Academy, 80% of the 8th grade graduates from the academy were accepted to elite area high schools. And no doubt that even propelled them and took them on into higher education when they went to college, which is a beautiful thing. Because, you know, a lot of times, you know, young, you know, Black kids don't really get financial literacy, you know, don't really learn at a young age, you know, how to budget and how you know, how to save for things that, you know, important, you know. And to be able to actually sit in on these board meetings that he's a part of, since he's a part of so many board, you know, boards on big companies, that no doubt is an invaluable experience for these young kids to be able to see. John Rogers also adopted a class of 46 graders at a cost of $200,000 per student through the I Have a Dream Foundation, and where he's going to pay for their college of about 30 of the students, which is huge. And also, you know, John is a friend of Barack Obama. He was a part of the inner circle of his presidential campaign. He's a long associate of the Obamas, and he even served as the co-chair of Obama's Illinois Finance Committee. And he also was a major fundraiser to his campaign and for Democratic Party candidates. So this brother has contributed a lot, you know. He's even honored by the University of Chicago, where he went, laboratory schools. The basketball court is named after him, and his name is printed on the floor during the winter break of the school year. And the court's new title was officially adopted on February 8th, 2012, in a ceremony corresponding with Lab's home game against their conference rivals. So the gym was, the basketball court was named after him. They have his name on the floor, and I'm sure that for him, since he played basketball in college, I'm sure that was, of course, it was an honor to be honored like that by your alma mater. But you know, John Rogers has accomplished a lot. You know, and he's still doing things and still sitting on these boards. And as we continue to go on, as he continue to live, and he's sponsoring all these young kids, he's paying it forward in the community by paying for these kids to go to college, by taking them to board meetings. That experience is going to help create, you know, many future businessmen and women, but because of these experiences. So John Rogers, we salute you for what you've contributed to Black history and Black culture, and what you're still contributing to Black history and Black culture now, today, you know, in 2020. Now, for the next person we're going to talk about and highlight was a man that was around during the 1800s. And this man goes by the name of Jeremiah Hamilton. And Jeremiah Hamilton was known as the richest Black man in the world during his time in the 1800s. He was born in about 1806 or 1807. He was from Haiti, Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And, you know, he was a Wall Street broker, very successful Wall Street broker. And he was able to actually go toe-to-toe with the other rich, you know, white men of his time. And you can imagine, since it was the 1800s, you know, and I'm talking about before the Civil War, way before the Civil War, the racism that he encountered by white people, because he was on their level. He was as rich as they were. He was sharp as a tack when it came to finances. He was a shrewd financial agent. And by the time he died in 1875, he amassed a fortune of $2 million, which in today's time is about $250 million and about 2018, 2019 dollars. So you can imagine, you know, in 1800s, you know, that's a big deal anytime, but especially in the 1800s when slavery was still abound, and even though, you know, New York was supposed to be a little more loose, it wasn't like the South. He still had to deal with much racism, despite his wealth and his position. Now, Jeremiah Hamilton wasn't like a good guy, you know. A historian by the name of James McCune Smith, the Black historian, he called Jeremiah the only Black millionaire in New York, and he wrote an article about him. He wrote a letter about him to Frederick Douglass in 1852, and he didn't really have too many good things to say about him. I mean, Jeremiah Hamilton, you know, at the time he married a white woman, which is very taboo. He married a white woman a lot younger than him, and even though they were married for 40 years and had 9 children, it was still very taboo at that time. And he didn't do anything to build up, you know, his community. You know, he kind of separated himself from other African Americans during the time. And whereas other, you know, African Americans who were businessmen at the time, because, you know, there were, you know, not everybody was, you know, poor slaves. There were, you know, quite a few, you know, African Americans who were businessmen, who were inventors, and who actually did make money during the 1800s. You know, they would always sell to their own, you know, their own community, and try and help their own community, the Black community. But he, you know, separated himself, and he, you know, just kind of stayed within more white circles. Now, the interesting thing about Jeremiah Hamilton is that, you know, there's not a lot of information on him today. He was kind of, you know, lost in the background. And during his time, there were a lot of newspaper articles about him. You know, there were over 50 court cases that involved him where he was either the plaintiff or defendant. And he was always in the newspaper because he went up against some... He went toe-to-toe with some big people. The Vanderbilt, Cornelius Vanderbilt, which was a big industrialist of the time, he went toe-to-toe with. And, you know, earned his respect. Even though Vanderbilt didn't like him, he still earned his respect and earned the respect of everyone who he went up against. But you can't find, there wasn't a lot of information on him as far as, you know, his life and everything. The bit of information that there is on Jeremiah Hamilton is because of an Australian historian who wrote a book about him, Shane West. And he wrote an article about him, talking a lot about his life and his accomplishments and how he was viewed in the public. But he, as mentioned, he was in a lot of newspaper articles. He was wrote about a lot, and yet you can't really find too much information on him prior to, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But just a little bit of background on him. He was born in 1806, or maybe 1807. He was from Haiti, and he came to America because he actually was here. He actually was in Haiti because he was he had some counterfeit coins. He was sent to Haiti to retrieve some counterfeit coins for a consortium of prominent New York merchants. And this was in 1828 when there was any record of him. He was just 21 at the time. And he was running counterfeit coins from Canada through New York to Haiti. And when he was discovered, he was helped by some fishermen. They helped him escape. And he was kind of stuck at the harbor in Port-au-Prince for about 12 days until he was able to get a New York vessel. He was able to board or stow away on a New York bound vessel. But the Haitian authorities sentenced Hamilton to be shot, so he wasn't able to go back to Haiti. If he ever stepped foot in Haiti during his lifetime, he was to be shot. They sentenced him in absentia to be shot. And so they nailed proclamations all over the island announcing this summary verdict and offering a $300 reward for anybody who saw him or knew about his whereabouts. But by the time, you know, he came to New York, there was a great fire in 1835 in New York that destroyed, blocks and blocks of property. And during this time, he was renting an office on Wall Street. And he profited handsomely from this misfortune. And as mentioned, he was a very shrewd businessman, a very shrewd broker. And his very existence, angered a lot of fellow white brokers during that time. And he knew how to feel his way around the economy's periphery. And he was adept at Wall Street. He was a skilled and innovative financial manipulator, and you know he actually cut a swath through the New York business. You know, New York business at that time was very white, and he was able to cut a swath through all of that. And starting in the mid 1830s, during this great fire, and he was able to take advantage of a lot of what was going on. Because of his methods, he was nicknamed the Prince of Darkness, and some other people just called him a nigger Hamilton, you know. So as we mentioned, there was not a lot of affection for him by his fellow white businessmen, because they just, you know, didn't even understand like why he was even there. But he profited handsomely because he took advantage of several of the fire victims' misfortune. He had no pity. And he pocketed some $5 million in today's currency. And within months, he joined in on a New York real estate boom. He invested more than $7 million in today's dollars to buy 47 lots of land in what is known as Astoria today, Astoria, Queens. And he brought up land along the docks and tracts of land up the Hudson River to all the way up to Poughkeepsie, New York, upstate. So because of this fire, this great fire in 1835, it allowed him to buy a lot of property. And this is just common business for a lot of rich businessmen. Even during the Depression of the 1930s, a lot of, you know, businessmen came and brought, you know, buildings and real estate on the cheap, And then when the economy turned around, they made a fortune. So he basically was just doing what a lot of the other businessmen would have done. But the only reason why it was looked upon as such a bad thing was because he was black. Now, there's no mention that the people he took advantage of were black. So we don't know that. But, you know, I feel like that would have been mentioned. But hey, we don't know. But he did take advantage of a lot of people and their misfortunes, and he made a fortune doing it. You know, he was aggressive. He was ruthless towards the competitors, you know, more so than other businessmen. And, you know, if you know anything about Wall Street and about business, you know, especially big business on this level, you know, they don't, you know, there's no kindness there. You know, and you can imagine that when a lot of these Wall Street men, these businessmen, you know, saw him, they took him for an easy mark. You know, it's the 1830s, 1840s. They probably thought that, you know, he was some easy mark, but he showed them quick that he wasn't, you know, to be trifled with in business. And, you know, New York businessmen played hardball, and he can play hardball with the best of them. Now, as mentioned, it's the 1830s, so he still suffered the same prejudice that, you know, all, you know, black Americans face during that time. You know, he was discriminated against as well. He had his relationship with the insurance industry was a bad one. In the 1830s, the New York insurance firms agreed to blackball Hamilton, and they refused to write any policies for any of his ventures. So he couldn't get any of his ventures insured. Now, they conspired amongst each other to against him, but even the DA in 1843, the district attorney, actually charged him with conspiring to defraud the Atlantic Insurance Company of $50,000. You know, the case was dropped, but, you know, even though the case was dropped and even though they tried to place all these obstacles in front of him, he always just found his way around it. Even if he had to lie, even if he had to lie or cheat, he always found his way around these obstacles to, you know, be successful. He even burst into a police office one morning and claimed that the Atlantic Insurance Company paid someone to lure him down to the end of one of the piers on the Hudson River and then drown him. So whatever he had to do to get around any obstacle to succeed against his opponents is what he did. You know, he had run-ins with the stock exchange in 1845. The public stock exchange, they passed a resolution that forbade members from buying or selling any shares for Hamilton under penalty of expulsion. And there was even a newspaper article about this, you know, in the 1840s. And during this time, you know, some businessmen cared more about the color of your money than the color of your skin. But, you know, these men were afraid to be exposed from the public stock exchange. So they, you know, played ball with this resolution that was passed. But, you know, Jeremiah Hamilton simply brushed that aside and, you know, he did what he had to do to get around those obstacles. He connived, you know, he went around, whatever he had to do, he did it, and he still continued to amass his fortune despite anything that was put in front of him. He even got, you know, personal and physical with some of his enemies. You know, there was a court case where, you know, a witness tried to denigrate his character, and he even got into a fight with the dude in the court, outside the courthouse, you know, like right outside outside the courthouse, him and this man were fighting, you know. So, you know, he say what you want to say about him, you know, about his character, you know, he was a black man in a white man's world and did whatever he could, you know, to succeed. You know, and he had to get down and dirty. He got as low as they did. If they went low, he got down to the floor with them. And, you know, even though he had a lot of disdain simply because he was black, they had to concede that he was a sharp man. They said he was sharp as a razor and knew exactly what he was doing. As we talked about earlier, in the 1850s, he went to a struggle with Cornelius Vanderbilt. And Cornelius Vanderbilt was like you know, like the first tycoon. You know, when you think of Rockefeller, you think about Andrew Carnegie. Cornelius Vanderbilt was up there with those guys. He was the epitome of capitalism, you know. And Jeremiah Hamilton went to war with him over the Nicaragua Transit Company. And even when Cornelius Vanderbilt died, the National Republican newspaper acknowledged that there was only one man who ever fought him to the end, and that was Jeremiah Hamilton. They didn't mention anything about his race, but they only elaborated that Vanderbilt didn't fear Hamilton because he didn't fear anybody, but without a shadow of a doubt, he respected him. So he was even able to earn the respect of, at this time, the richest man in the country, one of the first American tycoons, because of his tenacity and his sharpness in business. And, you know, he pursued whatever edge he could find in his dealings with white businessmen. He was unforgiving in his business practices because, as mentioned, he was a black man in a white man's world. When he was at work, he was the master of the universe. You know, he was successful. In all his dealings, he actually, you know, whenever he had business dealing with certain white men, because they would actually come to him to get financial advice, and he would make them kiss his ass. I mean, one man he actually made buy him hundreds of cigars and a bouquet with a bottle of champagne, and that was the only way he would have given this man the advice, the financial advice that he was looking for. You know, but despite all that, when he left his work and when he went home, he was barely a second-class citizen. He was looked at like any black person during that time. And, you know, for all the distance he put between himself and the rest of his people to white New Yorkers, he was just, you know, another Negro or, you know, another nigger or whatever. You know, and since he was married to a white woman, like we talked about before, whenever they left the house, it was an ugly scene, you know. He was a racist nightmare. He was rich. He was successful. You know, he associated with whites, and he was married to a white woman. And, she became pregnant with his child when she was very young. I mean, like, very young, and he was twice her age. And they had 9 children. They were married for 40 years, but as young as she was when she, you know, had his first child, it's like statutory rape, you know. So that wasn't looked at as anything good then, just like it isn't now to this day. And even, you know, as the Civil War raged on in the 1860s, because he started amassing his fortune way before the Civil War in the 1830s, by the time, you know, the 1861 came around and the Civil War was going on, you know, it was looked at by his position was looked at as absurd by, you know, white businessmen. A successful black man on Wall Street accumulating money, you know, not caring about who he pissed off, you know. they looked at him like, you know, who does guy think he is, you know. He was the master at manipulating speculations and shares, where the client bore, you know, all the loss, and he reaped, you know, he, no matter what, if the client lost money, he still made money. That's how it is even today with, you know, stockbrokers. He disgruntled a lot of people during his business, you know, but he always made sure that he benefited, and no matter what business arrangement he was given. He lived a large lifestyle. He didn't care who it offended, you know. He was successful, and he let it show. He was like a rapper, you know, like the same way rappers are today, where, you know, big chains, you know, all that, and very showy. That's how he was too. Now, we talked about, as I mentioned before, I was talking about that white client. In 1864, he demanded a white client who wanted to get points on a deal. You know, he wanted to get like some back end points on a deal. So he wanted this white man to acknowledge his kindness and to give him a basket of bottles of champagne and a box of 600 cigars. And only then did he consider that suitable. And he made sure that the man knew that it had to be the very best. Whatever the best name brands was, cigars or champagne, that's what he had to give him. And you can imagine how much money that cost. You know, for him to give him a box of 600 cigars and bottles of champagne. Shoot, and you know, that pissed off white people as well, because, you know, they didn't want to have to cow down to any black man. But yet and still, if you wanted his help, if you wanted his advice and finances, if you wanted any part of the dealing that he was dealing with, any deals he was dealing with, that's what you had to do. During that time, you can be a black man could be lynched for any of the stuff that he was doing. But, you know, he didn't even care. During the draft riots of 1863 in New York, they just started hanging people. You know, they were pissed off. The, you know, Irish folks in New York were pissed off about black men in the city. They just, any black man they saw, they just go string them up, if, you know, on a light pole. They were going to rich neighborhoods and just breaking into people's homes and stuff and just burning everything down. So they went to his home and they went down the street that he lived on, you know, broke into his house. And he wasn't there at the time, but his wife was. And so, you know, she knew what they were there for. She told him that he wasn't there. They left with some cigars, some clothes or whatever. And then they went on about their business. But, you know, they knew exactly where he lived. And they were going to looking for his house specifically so that they can riot it, so that they can hang him on a light pole. And this is what one of the men said to a neighbor who came to look and see what was going on. They said, we're looking for, you know, a nigga who lives around here. We're going to hang him on a pole and you can hang and you can stop and see the fun. That's the hate that, you know, these men had, that they were going to go into this man's house in front of his family, you know, riot and loot the place and then kill him simply because he was, you know, successful. But in the last decade of his life, you know, it was said that he got a little kinder. I mean, you know, we don't know because we don't know. There was no written record of any of his actions that were considered kind. But he took his family on a European tour, and you know, where they, you know, saw the city and everything, and you know, got to see, you know, other parts of the world. But other than that, there's no real record of anything that he might have, you know, done that would have made him look that as more respectable against, you know, other black contemporaries. But he died in May of 1875 at about 68 or 69 years old. And as we said earlier, when he died, his fortune was about $2 million, which is over $250 million today. And you know, that his life, his business, and, you know, if you look at his business practices against any of the other successful white men in history, you know, what he did was no different. You know, he was a ruthless businessman. He made sure that every deal worked in his favor. And, you know, he lived a good life. He lived a wealthy life. And it showed in his clothes. It showed in his style. It showed in, you know, who he hung around, you know, what type of man he was. And as said, he wasn't really, you know, he wasn't really revered in the black community because of the fact that he distanced himself from the black community. But in the world that he was in as a Wall Street broker, you know, he played with the big boys, and, you know, by all the white contemporary businessmen at that time, he won. You know, for the most part, you know, he always won in any battle that he fought, despite any obstacles, whether it was through the DA, whether it was through the stock exchange, newspapers, or this other disgruntled businessman. You know, Jeremiah Hamilton always made sure and came out on top. He always connived his way around obstacles or just found some other way to get around it. And he was able to amass a large fortune because of it. So we just wanted to talk about him and highlight him today because everything we've talked about him, you can imagine there was a lot of newspaper articles that were written about him, a lot of magazine articles that were written about him, but yet we don't see anything about him through history. Unless, you, I mean, now you can find him through the, you know, because we're in the internet age, but there's still not a lot of information about his life you know, and about what he's accomplished. And he was, you know, the richest black man in America when he died in 1875. And he amassed his fortune, you know, pre-Civil War, when in the South, black men and women were in chains. So, you know, we highlight his journey, you know, even though he might have engaged in practices that, you know, we look at today and might, you know, kind of sneer at, you know, because in today's quote unquote woke culture, you know, his practices were definitely not cool. But especially the marrying, you know, the young girl, and, you know, which was basically statutory rape, that's never cool. But we talk about his accomplishments and being able to survive in a world where he was the only black man and able to succeed at doing it. So, you know, we won't salute a lot of what he did, you know, because it's not salute worthy. But we do give respect for the fact that he was able to navigate his way in sharky waters and to amass a fortune while doing it. I'll put it like that. So today we just wanted to talk about him and his journey, and also highlight John Rogers and Ariel Investments and, you know, his company for what they've done, you know, what they're continuing to do, you know, for the black community, and you know, with him and taking these young kids to board meetings and showing them teaching them financial literacy. That's very important, because that right there is going to spur the next generation of businessmen and businesswomen, and we'll get more, you know, John Rogers and more Jeremiah Hamiltons, minus the screwed up, you know, personal practices, but just the tenacity for business to be able to survive and succeed, you know, in those, you know, shark infested waters of Wall Street and big business. All right, so we just wanted to talk about them today, you know, on Everyday Black History during Black History Month. And, you know, as we conclude this episode, we'll be coming at you with more black history. There's so much, like, we have so much to talk about. And that's why we call this Everyday Black History, because literally every day we could talk about something in history that our people, you know, across the whole African diaspora, black Americans, Africans, you know, Latinas, Latinx of African descent, you know, we've accomplished so much in this world, and a lot of times we don't get credit for it. So, you know, we have so much to talk about. We have much more that we'll be talking about, you know, for Black History Month. And majority, it won't be every day, but most of the time we'll be coming out with episodes, you know, highlighting our history. So that concludes this episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. And I know I sometimes you know, use certain phrases a lot, you know, and it may be a little annoying when you're listening to it, but that's because I'm just going off the top of the head and, you know, making it more personable, because, you know, some people have so much history, you know, to talk about. You just want to make sure you get it all right. So I apologize if I keep repeating certain phrases that may become annoying or monotonous. And I just hope you enjoy the material that we are presenting, you know, because our history is important. All right. So that concludes this episode, and we'll see you on the next one.